You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, a few minutes of the BBC, followed by A Public Affair.
This is Danielle Yawowiecka with the BBC News. Hello. The head of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, has said she's very concerned by forecasts that global trade will fall this year in the wake of President Trump's tariffs. The WTO says its latest estimate for 2025 is nearly 3 percentage points lower than it would have been without recent policy shifts. Dr. Okonjo-Iweala warned that a trade war between the US and China could affect the whole world.
Whilst US-China trade accounts for only around 3% of world merchandise trade, a decoupling between the two major economies could have far-reaching consequences if it were to contribute to a broader fragmentation of the global economy along geopolitical lines into two isolated blocs. Our estimates suggest that global real GDP would be lowered by nearly 7% in the long term.
President Trump says he'll personally meet Japan's trade negotiator on Wednesday to try to hammer out a deal on imports that works for both countries. Correspondents say Mr. Trump's involvement is a surprise and a sign of his eagerness to demonstrate the upside of his tariffs policy. The UK Supreme Court has ruled that the legal definition of a woman is based on biological sex. The government said the decision brought clarity and confidence for women and service providers. The case was brought by women's rights campaigners who challenged the Scottish government's interpretation of conflicting legislation on transgender women. The judges insisted transgender people would not be disadvantaged by their ruling, but Vic Valentine, manager of Scottish Trans, is unhappy with the ruling.
This might limit trans people's access to certain kinds of services and spaces. One reading of the judgment would seem to say that trans people might actually not be able to use either men-only or women-only services in places like hospital wards that might have single-sex wards. That then starts to beg the question of where trans people will be expected to go when we're recovering from illness or surgery.
The US Attorney General Pam Bondi has announced legal action against the state of Maine after it refused to comply with an order banning transgender athletes from women's and girls' sports. The Department of Justice has already tried to cut off federal funding for Maine's schools after President Trump clashed with its Democrat Governor Janet Mills over the legality of his executive order. The US Secretary of Education Linda McMahon warned her to expect a strong response.
We take the violations of women's civil rights very seriously. I have three granddaughters, and I want to make sure that they are treated fairly and that they aren't exposed, you know, in dressing rooms. We want to make sure that if you open women's sports or intimate facilities to males, you expose yourself to federal civil rights investigations.
You're listening to the World News from the BBC. The director of the UN's nuclear watchdog has told Le Monde newspaper that Iran is not far from developing a nuclear weapon. Rafael Grossi was speaking ahead of Wednesday's visit to Tehran for talks with Iranian officials, but Mr. Grossi stressed the IAEA was not party to US negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. The next round is to take place in Rome on Saturday, according to Iranian media. Iran has insisted its right to continue enriching uranium is non-negotiable, while President Trump's envoy says Tehran must desist. Satellite imagery of what was Sudan's largest refugee camp reveals that Zamzam has been mostly destroyed by the paramilitary RSF. Makeshift houses have been torched following its capture on Sunday, and in places the fires are still burning. Sudanese women's rights activists say RSF fighters committed mass rape during the attack. President Claudia Sheinbaum says Mexico will not have diplomatic relations with Ecuador as long as the newly re-elected Daniel Noboa remains in power. Ties between the two countries were broken last year after police stormed the Mexican embassy in Quito and arrested Ecuador's former vice president Jorge Glass, who'd sought asylum there while facing corruption charges. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has attended a lavish ceremony to mark the opening of 10,000 new homes in Pyongyang. The development is part of a five-year plan to provide 50,000 new homes in the capital. Mickey Bristow reports.
Dressed in a suit and tie, Mr. Kim cut a red ribbon to the sound of cheering crowds, music and fireworks. Mr. Kim claimed this would solve the city's housing problems. He seems to want to show that he's improving people's lives. That might be the case in Pyongyang, but its privileged population receives more resources than other parts of impoverished North Korea.
Mickey Bristow reporting. BBC World News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz presenting the Jimmy Ferrace Quartet at the North Street Cabaret on Friday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Jimmy Ferrace's recent debut album, Hours Fly, Flowers Die, is a heartfelt narrative with themes of nostalgia and the passage of time. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
Good afternoon, Madison. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. And today, we're talking to two incredible people who are live in the studio with us. On today's show, we're continuing our April theme of highlighting the role of the arts in times of political turmoil. We are joined by Jessica Becker and Jen Rubin of Wisconsin Humanities, an organization that promotes the preservation and celebration of our state's history and culture. Last week, Wisconsin Humanities was notified that all of their grant funding has been canceled. We'll talk about how this devastating news will impact the organizations as well as affect people across the state. Jessica, how are you doing today? Welcome to the show. Welcome to WORT 89.9 FM.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. That's a hard question to answer right now. Being the director of communications during a time of crisis is a challenge. And this really is a crisis. It's coming at us fast. It's changing all the time. And it's not legal. So we're trying to figure out how to respond.
Oh, man. That seems unprecedented, and I would imagine that you didn't get this job last week, that you've been doing this for a while. Is there anything that you can compare to this moment?
No, nothing at all. The funding originates with an act signed by Congress in 1965. It came to the states a few years later in 1971. They realized that the intention to have an informed and wise citizenry that was really important to people in the 60s. It was a movement, actually. And they realized that the best way to do that would be to give the states money to do what they wanted, meaning the states know themselves best and understand that there's rich culture and stories in each state. So those state offices were founded in the 70s. So we've been doing this work a really long time, and this is sudden and out of the blue.
I am so looking forward to this conversation, although I am already really sad about kind of this starting place. Although I gotta admit, Jen Rubin, you're one of my favorite people to talk to. So even talking about, we've talked about really sad things before. We've talked about our parents being sick. We've deep dived motherhood and all of those sorts of moments. This feels really different though, because I think what I know about the work you do is that you're really good at it and you really love it. And we're really lucky to have you doing it. And your position has been defunded. How are you doing today? How are you coping with that? Thank you so much for joining us on WORT.
Thanks for having me, Ali. And we've had many a conversation and the first time it's been recorded. Personally, it's devastating. Personally, you know, when I think about my sort of quirky, like 20-year road to all the storytelling stuff I've done and like built my skills, and then I actually had this opportunity to have a job that paid me and I could, you know, work with people around the state and help people tell their own stories exactly how they want to tell it, that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, not great for me personally, but just the thing about what this is a part of, right? I mean, we all know this. It's the Kennedy Center. It's like, you know, this administration is going after anything that helps give people the tools to think critically, right? What Humanities does is, you know, help people share like cultural heritage, their own cultural heritage, learn about other cultural heritage, right? The collecting histories. I mean, all of that stuff that is needed for us to be, you know, a citizenry of people that understands things, knows how to think about things, knows where we came from to help us decide where we're going. So I feel worse for the world than I do for myself, but I don't feel that great for myself either. You know,
I appreciate that, like, you have to take into consideration both what this means for you and what this means for all of us in terms of the kind of world we're living in. I think it's a pretty devastating blow to see humanities defunded by the you know, by the executive branch of our government, by our president. I also think, you know, the movement to defund public education, to defund critical thinking, to make higher ed less accessible to women, to people of color, to populations living in poverty, that's not actually an original movement to this moment. It just seems to be on steroids. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, Jessica, what is the political appetite or explanation for this defunding? How is this being reconciled? I think there's a lot of people who would say, I'm okay not funding humanities or storytelling if it means more people get health insurance, if it means more people get to live in safety and dignity in some other really important and profound way. What is this money going to be used to do now that it's not being used to support this really, really beautiful and important work you all are doing?
I like the way you pose the question in that, you know, it's not being used in to do the other things that we would, you know, it's sort of like, oh, I'll pay my taxes if that means that my trash will be picked up. We don't know that this money is being diverted from the humanities to do better things. In fact, what we know is that the budget to the NEH that gets funneled into every state and territory is a very small amount. And it's distributed fairly and responsibly based on the population of that state or territory. And what that money does when it gets to Wisconsin is it actually multiplies. And so for those who argue back, you know, some of the news reports that have shared this story in the last week do have the sort of counterpoint to say, well, this should be funded privately. And the problem with that argument is that the federal funding is the seed that inspires the additional funding. So without this this initial investment, communities all over the state don't have that that rationale or that reason for other investors to put in. And so we find that our grant program in just 2024, we fund grants all over the state. We have 7 grant rounds a year, typically. That's a 53-year-old grant program that just ended overnight. Those grants, when they go to communities, sometimes they're as small as $4,000, but they bring in a match of average 4 times that. And so that federal funding, what it actually does do here in Wisconsin is it brings in the private and the community match. And without that federal funding, you don't have the programming happening. And I do want to mention that one of the biggest problems in Wisconsin specifically is that we don't have state support in ways that other states do. In fact, we're 50th in the nation for state support per capita for arts and cultural funding. And so one of the reasons
so of 50
that,
states, there are 49 states yeah, that do a better job.
I'm like, is it the cards that are 52 or the states that are 52? Last.
No, we're very dead last. Occasionally we're 49th, sometimes we're 50th. So when you think about what that means, it means that this federal money is even more crucial. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a much more barren landscape in the arts and humanities than we currently have, which is already last in the nation. And so because we don't have the state support, we are truly out of luck when the federal government pulls this money. Our budget is just depleted. And without that state support, right now, the per capita funding in Wisconsin for arts and cultural programming is about 12 to 18 cents per person. And you compare that to Minnesota and Illinois, Minnesota spending over $10, sometimes it's $15 per person. So it's really, really a rough situation that we're in Wisconsin.
And one thing I want to add, too, is I feel like, you know, I think it hits rural smaller communities harder, you know. So, you know, so Madison, you know, for example, storytelling, which, you know, I'm a part of, like, there's a there's a robust community here, right? So a couple of weeks ago, Scott Schultz, who's on the board of Wisconsin Humanities, he's a former Marine, and he does a lot of work around writing and storytelling with vets. And so we went up to Neillsville, which is 2 hours from here, northwest, pretty small, very small town, to the High Ground Veterans Memorial Peace Park, and we did a day-long storytelling workshop with veterans, right? Like, you know, like that's going to go away, right? And I think it is going to impact the smaller communities harder.
I think that's such a good point to make, is like part of what you all do is you make sure that folks have these resources to tell their stories and to celebrate their culture and their community in a place where those resources are not abundant, where they're not easily and readily available. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Dolly Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. And before we get carried away in this conversation, I just want to thank Mary Jo for answering the phones. And I want you to remember that if you have questions about, you know, what is happening to the humanities and what it means to defund the humanities, give us a call. The number is 608-256-2001. If you want to speak directly to folks who are impacted by this loss of resources, give us a call. Jen is literally losing her job. And I think, you know, I wonder, like, how many people will be forced out of work? How many people will experience unemployment? How many things will be destabilized and destroyed in order for this federal government to do whatever it is they're doing? It doesn't feel like we know what we're doing. So it doesn't feel very transparent in terms of we're defunding the humanities in order to fund what?
Yeah, and you bring up that question of you know, how does this feel efficient? Because it is this DOGE entity that is arguing for efficiency, and I do think that that's the argument that many are making. While we need to be more efficient, it's not efficient to lay off. I mean, our entire staff will be laid off, and
how many people is that?
8.
So 8 people are losing their jobs.
And our offices will have to close. This is 53 years worth of work that needs to be packed up and hopefully archived in some way. And what that, again, means is that without the Wisconsin Humanities, which was established and is the independent nonprofit as congressionally mandated in every state, without an office in Wisconsin, there is literally no pass-through. There's no portal for that federal money to come here. And so we're trying to scramble to understand how to shut down our offices and lay off our staff at the same time that we maintain some hope that this office could continue to serve Wisconsin in the future should people come to their senses, right? Because we don't want this to be the end of humanities in Wisconsin.
It's so interesting that you bring up DOGE, because I think a few weeks ago when we were talking about the Supreme Court race, a lot of folks were talking about the role that Elon Musk had in kind of paving the way for Democrats to win, that people had a really negative reaction to Elon Musk interfering in local politics. And yet, he's still interfering in our local reality through DOGE. Talk to me a little bit about how you found out. Jen, how did you find out that you weren't going to have a job anymore?
Well, the timeline for me was, so the night of that Supreme Court race, and so I'm looking at the data county by county and trying not to be optimistic, but it felt clear that I should be optimistic, right? And then I see that this Jane Beachy, who I know from the Illinois Humanities, she posted on the article from the New York Times that said, not that they were going to defund us, but they were going to eliminate most of it. They were like, there's something.
The DOGE was in the NEH offices.
Yes. Yeah. And like things were going to happen. And so our executive director, Dina, is like, okay, we're all going to, we had our staff meeting Wednesday. Like, so again, not that we're going to be defunded, but like we needed to get organized and think about advocacy and, you know, because maybe things were going to happen. We didn't know what, but certainly not the defunding. And so then we were meeting in the office 9 a.m. to do stuff. And I walk in the office and Dina was like, yeah, no, I got in my spam email folder at midnight that Wednesday night. She got an email from the new acting director of the National Endowment for the Humanities saying, you are defunded as of last night. done, cease and desist or whatever. And I don't, you might, like, there was some weird language too.
It
was,
yeah, like, I don't mean to interrupt, but
no,
it is
do.
It is very interesting because you compare it to the founding legislation that was done with so much integrity and to so much celebration, and this literally landed in spam folders of the directors around the nation and had
like
to be
midnight,
dug out.
Right?
Yeah, and it was also from an unidentified source, but signed by the acting director because the past director was forced out. And so it's there's a lot of questions around how this announcement, it wasn't an announcement, how this information was passed along and obviously created scrambles around the nation. And so back to this point of efficiency, is this efficient? No, because we have no idea what we're supposed to do. But meanwhile, the money's gone. It was, as we walked in and Dina says, they took the nuclear option.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And it's also, I mean, you know this from the work you do, Ali, but it's just like, just the sheer level of disrespect that they have for anyone that's doing like anything that isn't just about how can they accumulate more wealth, right? It's like whether it's the scientists who spent their whole life perfecting this one thing or whether it's the humanities, it's like you don't even deserve our respect to like transition you out of here. Like, you know, we're just going to send it to your spam folder. Good luck.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to treat something like that as if it's legitimate. I'm curious about what folks are thinking. If you're out there listening, if you have questions about this, if you want to really deep dive, what is going on with the humanities? But we also want to celebrate why the humanities are important to you. So the number is 608-256-2001. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. Give a shout out to Mary Jo because she'll be taking your call. I also want to thank our producer, Sarah, and our engineer, Jay, for being just wonderful and amazing people and deep diving a series of really difficult and sometimes devastatingly depressing conversations with me on a weekly basis. You can't do that with people who aren't like your true friends. So huge shout out to the WOR team for making hard conversations possible, and huge shout out to you for listening to them and hopefully for participating, for giving us a call at 608-256-2001 to talk to us about why the humanities matter to you, and anything you want to know about what it's looked like for them to be defunded through our federal government. We are talking today to Jessica Baker, who is the Director of Communications at the Wisconsin Humanities, where she manages their annual communication strategy and oversees mission-focused branding to build relationships and engagement across the state of Wisconsin. We're also talking to Jen Rubin, who is the executive producer of the Wisconsin Humanities statewide digital storytelling project, Love Wisconsin, working with freelance producers from around the state. She is always looking for and helping to share new stories with our very active community. And I'm like, and you all are running out of time right now. So I started by saying the way you all were informed makes it hard to take it seriously. Was there ever a sense that maybe you should ignore this and go about your lives doing the work that you have spent your careers cultivating the capacity to do? Was there ever kind of a conversation about other options besides shutting down?
Well, you know, it is interesting because we know that we've had support from a bipartisan Congress for 53 years. And we know that legally we were included in the budget that was passed on March 15th and signed into law by President Trump. And so that is a legitimate reaction, like, but wait, this doesn't count. This is just a weird email. And then on top of that, we all know that everyone cares about their history, and it's something that the conservatives have built a case on, right? That they want to preserve and make America believe in itself and understand the power of our history. And history is perhaps the most accessible sort of root of what the humanities cultivates and what we do through different humanities conversations. The humanities has everything to do with just being human, which, you know, as we've evolved as humans, that means we can think about our history and we can imagine our future. And so any conversation that connects into those human capacities is the humanity. So we do believe that Congress understands the value of that. So it's confusing what's happening.
Oh man, I think what you said there struck a specific note for me, which is everybody cares about their history. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. It reminds me of something my father has said to me many times. So if you're out there listening, Gardner Muldrow, I remember as a kid asking my dad how Madison could be so progressive and racist enough to discriminate against children at school. And he had an answer that stays with me for the rest of my life. It is everybody's liberal when they're talking about themselves. Right. And I think part of what is happening here is that I do think Trump and J.D. Vance value their history and their heritage, but I don't think that they value my history and my heritage. And so I think part of the goal of a lot of what we're seeing is to erase an other, anybody who is not like them. And I think a lot of the work that you do, Jen, is create expansive opportunities for people whose voices have not been heard, for people from marginalized communities. And we've done that work together as part of the Odyssey Project or Odyssey Behind Bars. We're going in to do that work this Friday together. Talk to me a little bit about what this decision to defund the humanities means in terms of your ability to promote the storytelling of our incarcerated brothers and sisters.
Okay, well, there's like a lot of layers to that question. So I'll start the first thing.
Peel it back like an onion, my friend.
So a little background. So Ali and I do storytelling workshops in, we go to Oak Hill Correctional Institution here in Oregon. And then we go to Tichita in Fond du Lac. And then I'm connected with, also there's Racine in Columbia, and it's part of the Odyssey Behind Bars. And so it's an English 100 class that we don't teach, but we do a 3-part storytelling workshop. And so we do it every semester. And it's a really, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. It's a really, I do a lot of storytelling workshops with a lot of people, and it's always powerful and it's always impactful to help people share tools with people so they can build the story that they want to tell about themselves exactly how they want to tell it. And it's powerful for everyone, but it's particularly powerful to do it in prisons. And so the thing I've been thinking about, so when you go into a prison classroom, so these are roughly 12 to 15 students, and they are a range of races, ethnicities, economic backgrounds, right? It's like, it's a diverse classroom. And I kept thinking, like, because I think we're all like, oh, if only people could hear other people's stories and have empathy and whatever. But like in this space, because they're working on their stories together, you see people have that experience, right? You know, I'll let you do it, but you talk about this one man who told a story about his grandmother's jelly curl, you know, haircut. There's this, one of my favorite stories of someone who talks about not having a father figure, and the man who was important to him, he thought he had a penguin tattoo, so he devotes his whole sort of life to getting a penguin tattoo. It turns out it's a Ham's Bear tattoo in the end and not a penguin, you know. So, but like, my point is like we get into small groups on week two and everyone in the group really works with people on their stories, and you just see that empathetic connection across difference, right? And it's hard to get that anywhere else, you know, if you're not. And so I feel like I'm kind of rambling now and I should have had this set up better, but I feel like
some of the best stories I've ever heard in my entire life, some of the stories that I will always remember, have happened while we've been working together with incarcerated folks. And I think in that space, storytelling takes on a different level of profound meaning, because you're talking about people who have been incarcerated sometimes for the vast majority of their lives because of a single story.
Right.
Because of one moment, of one 15-minute interaction or something that happened over the course of a half an hour that has changed the entire trajectory of their lives. And that's the story that they have been defined by.
Well, to your point about the story being defined by, because I feel like people say to me, oh, isn't it really hard to work with people in prison on their stories? I'm like, no, you put any 15 people in any room and only a third of the room is going to tell their most painful moment. A third of the room is going to tell their favorite childhood story or whatever. But to your question of like, with Wisconsin Humanities being defunded, what is lost? One of the things I've been able to do, having the infrastructure of a Humanities Council is to bring these stories out to the world. You know, so we got to bring in Dasha Kelly Hamilton, who used to be the state poet laureate, and Adam Carr, who's a Milwaukee public historian. And we did these podcasts called Human Powered, and sort of telling the story of humanities at work within Wisconsin prisons. And so that I can't just do that on my own, right? Like that, you need the public infrastructure of a Humanities Council.
Yeah, you do. We have an anonymous caller who wants to know if Wisconsin Humanities is considering taking action, non-compliance, or coordinating with other states. Jessica, I'm going to ask that question to you.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that is a good question because we're talking about the legality of this. And there are a lot of things happening. Obviously, this defunding of the operational grants to the state offices of the NEH is not the only thing happening. We are working. We are lucky to have the 56 offices, as well as our connective tissue is through the Federation for State Humanities Councils. And that is being pursued, but it takes a lot of work and it's not going to happen fast enough.
It's, I really appreciate like the reality of what you just said. And at the same time, I think there is like this wish that if you can do this, if you can cause this much damage this quickly, that you can repair it just as quickly. And I think it is a real reality check when you go, that's not how this works. You can't take it apart and put it together in a matter of moments. These are real people. This is their lives and their careers and their work and these huge projects that people have really worked hard to create. And all of that is being jeopardized right now in a way that'll be hard to recover from no matter what action we take in response to it. Jen, I feel a little bit like, I don't know if you remember the movie Twister.
Yes.
But there's this part where she's like, you know, seeing a tornado miss this house and miss that house and like somehow come for you. You're the first person I know personally, like love and care about and know in my real life who is losing their job because of this administration. Do you feel a little bit like the tornado landed on your house? Like there's all these other houses. Why is storytelling the target of the United States federal government?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I had like a mental list in my head of like who I was most worried about. Like, oh, my cousin, because she works at the Smithsonian. Oh, okay, well, she's a single mom. She's gonna go under. But like, she's got to move in with that. Like, I had a whole thing, and I really didn't think I personally was gonna be it. But of course, why would any of us think that? Like, they're going after everything. So why would any of us think we wouldn't be hit? But that said, I didn't think that storytelling was going to be taken out.
No,
fully.
I work in abortion. Yeah. We've joked about this.
When Trump first got elected, I texted you like, what do you need from me? Like, they're going to come after you. So, but anyway.
No, and I was like, hey, when we go to Cheetah and teach storytelling, just make sure they let me out.
Yeah.
You know, and if they don't, like, work.
Make some noise.
Yeah, get me home. Yeah. So I think it's interesting because we, like, had that conversation about the work I do in working in reproductive freedom and abortion access in the state of Wisconsin. And I never thought, like, yeah, they're going to come after the humanity. It just seems really benign and pointless and harmful to eliminate the humanities, to go after this pot of money and the people who are doing this work throughout the state. I feel like I'm grasping at straws and being like, I just don't understand why this is happening. And it's weird because it feels like it's happening to you all and you don't necessarily understand why it's happening.
I mean, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no.
You might have a more official thing to say, so go.
Not so official, but as you're talking, I'm realizing that part of the struggle is in the word humanities and the misunderstanding about what power and value and impact and importance this has in our lives, and not recognizing that it's sort of the connective tissue of our world. You know, we can talk about some examples, right, of what Wisconsin Humanities funds or does through its programming. You've talked about Love Wisconsin a little bit with Jen's work and the partnership with the Odyssey Beyond Bars. And our grant program I've mentioned, so it might help to also talk about another program that we run out of our office is the is a fellowship, and what the fellowship offers is training for local leaders, community leaders who are selected. It's a very competitive program. It's a nationally award-winning program in the humanities, and fellows are selected. They stay in their communities, and they get training over the course of 6 months to learn some skills that they can specifically take back to their own project ideas, to their own community needs, to the things that their community has said we want to do better, whether it's a tour of the historical architecture on Main Street, or it's bringing new neighbors together to talk about their traditions, or whether it's mapping the resources and assets in a community for the teens, or, you know, these kinds of things. These people say, we want to know how to do this stuff better. So we train them. And then for the second 6 months, they actually get a small stipend to invest in a project. And so that training is ending. And that's a very unique program, again, nationally awarded winning program that invests in Wisconsin communities, and that is run through Wisconsin Humanities, and that's going away.
I do want to just say, when you were talking about, like, why us, right? And so, I mean, I don't know this to be true, but, you know, these words that have now become political words, right? Democracy is a political word. Humanity is a political word. And I was, you know, I first started Love Wisconsin in 2020. And the women who created it had built this, you know, 100,000 plus Facebook audience. What their goal was to cut across the difference, urban, rural, conservative, liberal. So there's this very rich, active audience. And I got hired coming into the 2020 election. I'm like, okay, it seems like suddenly people think that poll workers are the enemy. So let me do a Love Wisconsin story series on poll workers. And like, what does it look like up in Lac du Flambeau? What does it look like in Madison? What does it look like in a small town? What does it look like in, you know? And so I did all these stories, and they were really great stories, and people were enjoying it. So I thought, well, let me, you know, boost the story. And I got flagged from Facebook because they're like, trying not to use inflammatory words heading into the election. And what the two words that got it flagged was democracy and poll workers, right? And so there is this idea, I think, that these words that many of us think are benign, like humanity, democracy, just are not, they no longer are. They're not political.
Yeah, I mean, I think of those words as nonpartisan. And I think that the partisan politics really plays an interesting part in the conversation that we're having. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair, and we are talking about the role of the arts at a time of political turmoil with Jessica Becker and Jen Rubin. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 608-256-2001. We would absolutely love to hear from you. I think stories build bridges, you know, and I think one of the major issues that was talked about during the November presidential election of 2024 was how divided we are as a nation. And I think there were a lot of people hoping that we could become a less divided nation, that we could find a way to bridge our gaps in understanding and to recognize our shared humanity and realize no matter how different we are, we're all just people doing the best that we can. It feels like that bridge building is actually what's under attack, that there is a desire to, you know, it's harder to hate an immigrant if you know how much that immigrant loves their mom and their community and their school, and you know that they're 8 years old, right?
Yeah.
And so if you all are telling that story, it gets in the way of the story that is these black and brown people are violent animals who deserve to be incarcerated and tortured and treated very poorly, and their children are a menace, and, you know, they're nothing like you. You have no reason to care about them. Where do you go from here in terms of kind of your personal commitment to this work, to giving your lives and your careers to this work? Jessica, I'm going to start with you. If you can't do this, what are you going to do?
Oh boy.
I was like, are you my father?
Get a job.
good question. Well, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I've been trying really hard not to be in a panic mode, because I also think that that's part of the plan, is to put us all into a panic mode. And I have been doing this work for over 2 decades. I come out of a museum field. I have an education degree, and it's who I am, and I'll keep doing that. So I'm trying not to be in a panic mode, because I also think that that's part of the revolution, or the radical sort of resistance, is to not panic, and to keep doing the good work. Maybe I'll leave it there.
I love that you're not panicking. I feel like me and Jen are prone to panic. We're like, this is, you know, we've had this like Jewish black, like primed for the government to do things that are really bad conversation before. Whereas I remember I was telling you something about, I went to something in Philadelphia, and they were talking about the MOVE bombing. And a man came up to us on the street. We're with children. It's a whole group of kids. They're learning like the history of Philadelphia. This man comes up to us on the street and goes, I just want you to know those people did not deserve what happened to them. The government did that, and they will do it again. And you were like, I bet you he was Jewish. and I keep that moment with me like all the time. I also think like, I grew up on stories about slavery. You grew up on stories about the Holocaust. There's got to be a part of this moment that feels familiar in terms of your orientation to oppression, your orientation to discrimination and hatred.
Well, I was going to answer your what am I going to do next with my life question, but
I mean, that's important too.
I gotta step in and say my attempt not to panic is not because I don't get the historical references. I was trying to answer your question about what are you going to do next. I'm trying not to panic about my bank account.
Yes, no, mad respect for that. I'm for you channeling your inner peace if you can manage it, and I know like you're saying trying. With a lot of like it's effort to like stay grounded in this moment. And still I'm curious for my friend who's prone to panic.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like we should save some of this just for the card, because I feel like there's no the most honest answer for me is sort of a divisive answer, which I'm sure whoever's listening half will really agree with me and half will really send me to, well, we can't, whatever, send me somewhere, not be happy with me, which is I feel like right now, with the right wing weaponizing anti-Semitism to undo democracy, like as a very like being Jewish is very important to me. It's a huge part of my identity, and like there, you know.
Jen, you're over here taking it there now.
Yeah. So anyway.
You're like, I'm going to tell the story for real. You guys don't even employ me anymore.
Well, no, that's all I'm saying.
You're weaponizing my heritage.
You just asked me what, anyway, so I'll leave it at that. So that's complicated. And that's decontextualizing history. And that's why the humanities matter. You know, just to circle back a little bit on this topic, but around Love, Wisconsin. So, you know, Love Wisconsin is one of the Wisconsin Humanities programs. And to the point of, we're going to try as best as we can to keep the organization as a shell existing. But the programs are going away because the programs cost money. And so the kinds of things you can do with storytelling is whatever year it was that the Wisconsin legislature unanimously decided that you need to teach about the Holocaust and other genocides in school. And I was so... I couldn't believe it. This is the same time that other state legislatures are saying you can't teach all these things in the school. So I was just, let's do stories on people who actually do that teaching in the schools, right? And so this one woman, Nancy, her father was a Holocaust survivor. And she said she didn't teach about it until he died. And once he died, she felt like it was her job. So she talks about in the story, like they went down to the museum in Skokie. This was some small town somewhere a couple hours north of Milwaukee. And then she was in the classroom. And then a student, I'm not doing this justice, but a student raised her hand and said, my mom's friend, what my mom's friend said the Holocaust never happened. And so, and asked him a question about that. And Nancy was saying it was this really exciting moment because this kid had this cognitive dissonance, right? Because she's hearing Nancy. Nancy's showing a video of her and her father together in Hungary visiting where his family was. But yet she's told this thing by probably her mother and not her mother's friend. And she's having this moment of cognitive dissonance, right? Which is, allows for original thought, right? And so that's what, I don't even remember what the question was, but I feel like that's like what we're losing, right? We're losing programs that matter very deeply to me, right? Like, I know how to tell a good story. I know how to help people tell a good story. To your point on bridge building, when we teach storytelling workshops, Ali and I and other people, it's like, yes, you have a good memory. Yes, you have a good anecdote. But if you want, we all feel jealous of a sibling. We all feel disappointed by, right? We all have that, right? And so if you don't weave that into a memory or an anecdote, it's not going to move anybody, right?
Mm.
And that's what storytelling is. And you're supposed to keep me on track, Ali, and now off track.
I mean, but, I love everything you have to say. This is why we're friends, is because I think you have a way of like letting this kind of, the kind of organic flow of conversation be meaningful and beautiful and reverent to your identity. I think part of why I love stories is because they make space for complexity in the ways that I think are erased in our daily lives and in so many instances, right? Like, I think there's so many things in this world that try to turn us into like a number or a clog in a machine. And storytelling lets us be who we actually are and lets us make meaning of our lives and the people that we love and lets us talk about our dads and our sisters and our brothers and our kids and our history and our identity in ways that are deeply important to us. I do want to ask you what's next for you, Jen. What comes after this? And then I have a desperate question for you.
I truly have no idea. I feel like I just turned 59 Monday. I don't even know. I don't know what's next to me. I'm just going to say
like super hot for 59.
Oh, okay, well, thank you.
You know, like
that works well on an auditory medium here. So thank you.
I mean, I wish we were filming right now. My friend is so good looking. You guys should know.
Okay. Well, two things. Well, so I am just going to say this in case anyone has it. Ali and I have a side dream, which is we're going to, our love of setting people up, it's called the front porch yentas. So if anyone wants to be set up, get in touch with us.
That's the next phase is like the matchmaking service that we'll have. Cause you know, there's no better story than a love story. And in my opinion, almost every story is a love story.
But I'll say the one other thing that brings in history, and it's my own personal thing, and I do hope I can find a way to be employed somewhere, but that might not happen. But I am on the Midwest Bagel Quest, and this brings in the humanities and history because I'm a New York Jew driving around the Midwest tasting and judging Midwest bagels, and I have through archives, I believe I am now, as a judgy New Yorker living here for 28 years, I'm going to tell the untold story of the Midwestern bagel because we have been flyovered with the bagel historians, and that is what I've learned. So it's not a job, but until something better comes along, that's what I'm doing.
I like that you're just committed to your art form. You're like, I'm going to keep telling stories. I'm going to keep making art. I'm going to keep highlighting voices and small businesses across the state until they find another way to stop you. I think my desperate question for you, Jessica, is there a conversation with the UW about finding the resources to fund this beyond what the federal government does? And I know that the universities and UW-Madison and universities across the country are under attack. We have a caller who I want to bring on in just a second, but I do want to ask really quickly, is there some other pot of money that can swoop in and save the day?
I wish. And if there's someone listening who can help there, we are.
If you are out there and you've got big check you want to write, this is the time to do it.
We are ready to figure that out in terms of bridge funds that will sort of carry us through hibernation and so that we're ready when things change. That is the goal at the moment. I do want to give a shout out to the university systems. They have been our fiscal partner since the beginning, and that is because of the Wisconsin idea from the beginning. When the state offices were founded in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin idea informed this concept that that information and research and knowledge and wisdom is for the people. And so we have been affiliated with UW Systems. And they've been wonderful through this process because it's a very complicated, you know, how does one get laid off? But they're not going to be able to step up and save us because, as you said, there's the tax coming from a lot of different places. And so I feel obliged to also go back to this panic question to say, like, I actually have been telling friends and family now is the moment to panic, in the sense that when history is being erased, and it literally is being erased, taken down off of websites, real stories of what happened on January 6th have been taken out of the Library of Congress archives and websites. This is actually the moment to start, if you haven't been already. And I think that's the difference. It's like, if you are following the news and you're sort of like a panicky type, but if you're just kind of like, well, it'll work itself out, start paying attention. Real things are getting erased. And as you've been saying, that attack on the bridge building, the attack on the histories and the cultures, it's very deliberate, and it's kind of revenge politics right now. I think it is a moment to panic on that level.
I completely agree with you with my whole soul. Yeah. And honestly, I've been panicked for a long time. I think when people started getting really passionate about banning books, I felt as a storyteller, as an artist, as a poet, I felt really scared about the kind of world that my kids are going to grow up in. We have a caller. Hopefully you're not just here to stoke the flames of our panic and collective terror, but if you are, you're in good company. You're in solidarity. Thank you so much for joining us today on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. How's it going, caller?
Hi, Ali. This is Jade. And hi, Jen and Jessica.
Oh, my God.
Hi, Jade.
Jade, you know, like, we love you and we're obsessed with you and loved running into you at that concert. You're the best.
I don't know that I have anything huge to offer as I was listening to you guys talk, but I just, in this moment, want to say that the work that y'all do has enriched my life in just like physically and who I am as a person, as a storyteller, as you know, in my career. And I you know, I really hope that something, you know, the white parachute comes down and saves Wisconsin humanities. But it's so important, the work that you guys do.
Thank you, Jade. And I think that what you can represent in that is that there have been so many people touched by this work, and I've had an amazing career and gotten to travel all over the state and work with communities, community groups, nonprofits, cultural centers, libraries, schools all over the state. And so I do know that people come up to me and tell me, oh my gosh, that program that, you know, one of the first things that I did was help to tour three different Smithsonian exhibits. Those Smithsonian stops happened in communities of less than 10,000 people. There was a competitive process to select communities that were all raising their hands saying, yes, bring this resource to our main street. And they wanted it because it brought in tourists. It helped them create additional programs that gave them opportunities to reflect on their histories and their cultures. And so I still run into those people who I worked with to bring the Smithsonian to Main Street. And those programs that they started because they got the Smithsonian in town are still happening. Yeah. And so there are so many people like Jade and others who have been touched and had their lives changed and will hopefully be continuing to do this good work.
Yeah, Jade, I mean, you know, I'm a crier. So if you're going to call and say something that's just like super sweet and hopeful about like how necessary and important this work is and how we love it and you want to believe that you can save the things that you love. And it's hard to feel like we can't right now. And at the same time, I think like it's really, really important to talk about kind of the significance of not just what you do, but like what the absence of this work is actually going to mean in people's real lives. And so
Jen, I want to give you just a second to talk about kind of your favorite moments in storytelling and kind of things that stand out to you in terms of how this work has shaped your life.
You mean that I've done through Wisconsin Humanities?
Yeah.
So I guess there's two things for me. One is, so I produce this, you know, statewide digital project, Love Wisconsin. And I have a love of small businesses because I grew up in small businesses. And so when I started the project, there's this book that the Wisconsin Historical Society Press put out called For Love and Money. And it was all these like tiny, like 4 or 5 generation small businesses. And I'm like, well, let me start doing them. So I got in touch with this guy, Taylor, who I wish I remembered his last name. He's up in Hayward. And he's a 5th generation horse logger, which already is insane to me, right? Like, you know, that's, and so anyhow, so, And in his telling his story, and it's a very different story than my immigrant family, you know, escaping Russia, whatever, versus his, they started horse logging back in the 1860s. But there is this common, like, a small business story is a small business story, right? So I felt a personal connection to it, but also learned about this just entirely different way. You could live your life as a horse logger in Hayward, Wisconsin. I very much love that I've been able to bring my storytelling workshops, do it through Wisconsin Humanities and going into the prisons. And then, you know, and then bringing you in and Nestor Gomez in and Daniel Harrison Green in and Brendan Pankey in to do these workshops. And I would still say one of my favorite moments, which might be one of yours too, is we were in Oak Hill about 3-4 years ago. And there was this guy in there, Robert Taliaferro, who had been in prison for a very long time.
We love you, Robert.
Yeah. And we learned all these things from him. He had been in the CIA, all these things. And he, in his telling his story, we learned that he ran an award-winning prison newspaper out of Stillwater, Minnesota prison back in the 80s. And he was getting out in a week. And we were like, what? And so from that, we did an entire podcast episode on him and on prison newspapers. And we were able to bring in Shannon Ross, who does a community in Milwaukee, who did a much more modern version, email version, you know, of a newspaper when he was in prison, because it was no longer the 1980s, you know, and so things had moved on. So anyhow, just like those, getting to meet people and make those connections and seeing how it connects to.
No, I mean, yeah. You mentioned one of my favorite stories is definitely we were working with a guy and you think prison is going to be all these guys being so tough. And this guy was like, when I was a kid, I loved my grandmother so much that when she went to the barber shop, I went with her. And when she got a jerry curl, so did I, that I could look like my grandma.
Yeah.
And I can barely think about that story without crying.
I know. So well told, too.
And it was just, yeah, we've got no time left.
Okay.
And I have so many more questions for you. And I think part of what I wanted to ask about is, like, when you are attacking a people, you distort their economy, you distort the way that they get food, you poison their water, you destroy the things that are meaningful to them. Do you all think that part of what's happening to you is a warning shot in terms of what's to come? And what are kind of lessons learned? I'm gonna ask you, Jessica, in 30 seconds, can you tell us what's something we should observe about what's happening to you all and take into consideration in terms of how it may impact our future significantly?
Well, I think there are stories in history. We can look to other countries that have had this happen before. There was a cultural revolution in China where the intellectuals were attacked, where the arts and culture were erased, and where that took that country back. And obviously, we've referenced the Holocaust. I mean, this has happened before, and it's a playbook, and it's happening here. And I think that the idea of sort of American exceptionalism is over. This idea that a democracy will last forever isn't true, and that I do think that this is not just a canary in the mine or a. This is happening in our country, and we need to get over the idea that we're somehow different.
I want to thank you both so much for joining me today on WORT 89.9 FM. Thank you for, you know, letting us know that this is where totalitarianism starts, and we have observed it around the world. Thank you all for tuning in. Happy Wednesday, everybody.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
And I think the story of the Black labor movement is an example of that. Like, we don't all have to agree all the time. We can fight, and those fights can lead to tactical innovation. But the key is that, you know, if we're going to be together on this, we need to have those conversations and at some point perhaps agree to disagree and be united in a common strategy. That is what the Black labor movement did. And I think that is what whatever new mass movement comes out of this moment must do in order to succeed.
Our guest is Cedric De Leon. He is the author of the book Freedom Train, Black Politics, and the Story of Interracial Labor Solidarity. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison, and now we join the BBC News.
Trade Organization Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala says she's very concerned by forecasts that global trade will fall this year. She linked the reversal to the tariffs introduced by President Trump.
Based on the trade policies currently in effect, we project that global merchandise trade volumes will decline nearly 3 percentage points below the level we would have expected. This downward revision reflects the combined impact of newly introduced tariffs and heightened uncertainty.
Mr. Okonjo-Iweala said